Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 227 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me tonight is the most patient hostess ever, Aaron Paulette. I don't know how I'm doing, but how are you doing, Aaron?
My back hurts. A lot hurts. I'm old. Hello. Between the pre-show jackery and you flubbing the intro a bunch of times, and I'm drinking rum to cope, and of course the leave I'm taking, yeah, we're not all here, I think.
We were somewhere outside of Barstow near the edge of the desert when the drugs began to take hold. I remember turning to Aaron Paulette and saying, I feel a little bit lightheaded. Maybe you should drive.
We can't stop here. This is bat country.
Oh, Dr. Thompson, we miss you so much.
I know that you're not a big comic book reader, but have you ever heard of the series called Spider Jerusalem? Well, okay, I'm sorry. That's not the series. The series is called Transmetropolitan, but the main character is called Spider Jerusalem.
I think is that the guy that looks a lot like Hunter Thompson with the sunglasses, the two different color lenses?
Yes, that's him. And that's exactly where I was going with that. Spider is basically a science fiction Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh, he is based, because I remember... It's actually back in the Live Journal days. There was a friend of mine who had one of his Live Journal avatars was Spider Jerusalem, and for the longest time I thought that it was Hunter S. Thompson, because Spider Jerusalem looks a hell of a lot more like Hunter S. Thompson than Uncle Duke does from Doonesbury. Who is also supposedly supposed to be Hunter S. Thompson, and I believe Hunter S. Thompson threatened to kill Gary Trudeau, because that's how he ruled. Gary Trudeau? It's not Justin Trudeau. I forget which Trudeau is the one that writes.
I'm pretty sure it's Gary Trudeau, and I think that Justin Trudeau is the current PM of Canada.
Yes. Yes. All I'm going to say is Gary Trudeau is a brave American hero. Nobody writes straw man arguments like he does.
Speaking of straw man arguments, I'm gonna force us back onto the road, and we've got something involving Shannon Watts being herself.
Yes.
Oh, please take it. I feel like I'm gonna throw up.
Yes. Oh man, it's saying the tweet is not found. Do I need to dig? Did she delete it? I guess. I don't know, but either way,
I've still got the tabs open. So,
okay. Well, why don't you read the tweet real quick, and I'll figure it out in post so that the people can read it.
Okay. So the first one, which was December 1st, and she says Kevin Jackson is a legal gun owner, even though Texas doesn't require permits to buy a gun, and that parenthetical was completely irrelevant. And has no criminal history. A grand jury will now decide if this black man acted in self-defense. A reminder that Texas's lax gun laws only apply to white people. And so she's got a link to a news article in which a Dallas store customer facing murder charge for shooting unarmed robber. And just to give a little bit of context here, so Kevin Jackson was shopping in, I think, a convenience store, and another person came in, and the clerk recognized the person who came in, and she recognized him as someone who had stolen from the store before, and she asked the guy to leave and to return what items he stole, and he left and then came back and he started hitting her. And so Kevin Jackson, acting in the defense of another, shot and killed the man. And it was determined that there were indeed stolen items on his person. And he was... Okay, I'm not entirely sure how Texas works. I do remember they said that he's facing a grand jury, which is a little miniature trial to see if there's enough evidence to take him to trial. Mm-hmm. And probably as part of the grand jury, he will plead justifiable homicide defense of another, and that will be that. But basically what she's saying is that if it was a white person, then that white person wouldn't have been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
So then there is, I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
Well, yeah, and I also wanted to say, just for the impaneled grand jury, there is an old saying that a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. So just because if in fact the grand jury does choose to indict and it goes to trial, that really doesn't mean anything, though. I am with you, Aaron, and hoping that in a just world, it'll just be, yep, no, we're good. This is Texas.
Mm-hmm. And so the second tweet, and this is where things get nested inception style. So, okay, because it's nested three deep, and you've got Shannon Watts replying to someone who's replying to Shannon Watts, who on the 30th of November summarized what I just said. Okay, it's not convenience store, it's Family Dollar. A Family Dollar store customer saw a man fighting with store employees and fatally shot him, saying he was, quote, concerned for their safety, unquote. He's been arrested for murder. This is what the NRA tells us to do. Always be armed and shoot anyone for any infraction. First of all, fudge you, Shannon Watts. Secondly, that's what she said. And then I don't really know how to pronounce the diacritical. Shayon McNeil, quote, tweeted and said, "This isn't what you said yesterday in your now hidden tweet," which is what we just did earlier. "Care to explain what changed your opinion?" And Shannon replies, "My tweet is not hidden, and I could find it, but you couldn't, so I don't know." It's both. Okay, I have to read this in sarcasm font. I can't just say it straight. "My tweet is not hidden. It's both true that the NRA tells Americans to be armed and shoot to kill alleged shoplifters, which is absurd and dangerous. It's also true that the NRA is racist and won't support black people who engage in what gun extremists call self-defense." So, yeah, again, fudge you, Shannon Watts. The NRA does not tell Americans to shoot alleged shoplifters. This man, okay, he shot someone who was, yes, an alleged shoplifter, but was also assaulting a woman, which is a forcible felony, which can be responded to in lethal force. And then Shannon replies to the second bit, and she mentions, and I hate that it is, it may not be 100% true, but it's more true than it's not. And she's talking about how the NRA is pretty silent when black gun owners or victims are shot and killed, like Tamir Rice and Philando Castile and other people I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, Tamir Rice, was that the kid in Ohio that was playing with like an airsoft gun in the park?
I think we've established on record how terrible I am with names in general. Just to put this in context, I really have a hard time remembering the names of my neighbors who have lived next to me for years. However, I can very easily go, oh yeah, they're Rocky's parents, Rocky being their dog. Mm-hmm. I can remember dog names like that. It's just people names that give me problems.
And that's the funny part, because dog names have far less conventional rules for people. A dog can be named Joe. A dog can also be named Flufflebutt, and no one's going to say peep about it, or Frisky. it goes through. That's like, I find myself, I have a really hard time if I meet somebody that's got for lack of a better term, an ethnic name. They are from a culture that is not Western European, and so they have a name that is fairly unique to my ears. It's probably not unique from where they are, but to my ears it is, and I find myself having a hard time remembering that, because when I meet yet another Steve or yet another Liz, I can go, oh yeah, that person, they're in the Steve category. I have a long list of Steves, and all of these people I could say, hey, Steve. I don't know, but That's interesting that you remember the dog days, but also dogs are cute. They leave an impression.
Exactly.
People are boring. But yes, yeah, Tamir Rice was a 12-year-old boy who was in Cleveland, Ohio, and he was in a park playing with a replica firearm that did not have any of the bright orange business on it. It was a very realistic-looking gun, and I'm not 100% sure because the only recordings of this is a very, very grainy security camera. And the footage that I saw of it was not even complete. It seemed to skip around a bit. But the police mistook the firearm for a real gun and he was pointing it around at people, and which I would argue isn't, I'm not making a judgment call at all on Tamir Rice, but to put him on the same level as Philando Castillo, which was a far more controversial case, in my opinion, is not the same. And but the NRA was indeed silent. Shannon Watts is correct, I wasn't pleased about that either, specifically with the Philando Castillo. But needless to say, Shannon Watts is playing both sides of it. She's trying to pretend like she's the smartest person in the room and she's playing 3D chess, but yeah, she's saying, oh, this is horrible. This man was just stepping up to save the day and he's got arrested for murder because he's black. And then at the same time also saying that, oh, this is what the NRA tells you to do. Go ahead and just run around murdering people. Well, it's which one is it? And of course, the thing that immediately came to my mind was, I think I remember Shannon Watts tweeting about one Kyle Rittenhouse, who, first may I note, is not black. As a matter of fact, he is extremely pale. And she's one of these people that was openly calling him a murderer even after he was acquitted. And was certainly in favor of him spending the rest of his life in prison at age 17. I think it was 18 at the time when he was actually on trial. So yeah, oh yeah, those poor black men that are getting arrested just because they're black for defending themselves. Oh yeah, and there's also this guy that has probably the most well-documented self-defense case in the history of self-defense, with just all the number of cameras and angles that they had of Kyle Rittenhouse defending himself. And yet here she was cheering for him to go away for murder when it was clearly anything but. So yeah,
do you know what that hashtag is? 'Cause I don't recognize that. WILEG.
I do not.
Okay, I've Googled it and come up with nothing. I was hoping you would know.
Okay, well maybe one of the listeners will know and they'll reach out to us because I don't know, and I've got, this is an archived tweet, so I can't click on it to see what other stuff has. Yeah, no, I don't know.
I'm on Twitter and I did a search for the hashtag and I see it, and Shannon has been using it a lot in tweets. I just don't know what it stands for.
Yeah, I'm just peeking around and seeing if I could see anything.
I think it's something about the Wisconsin legislature.
Maybe.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Because there's one of them. I see one of these things. It's not her, but it's hashtag capital W capital I capital L lowercase EG, and it has something to do with the Wisconsin government, and I see the outline of the state. I know it's now incredibly boring, no one cares. I had no idea what it had to do with anything.
Yep. Well, given the deep intellectual nature of these tweets, Shannon Watts probably has a strong grasp on what it means. He said facetiously, I'm calling you dumb, Shannon. But this is just how ghoulish anti-gunners can be, in the fact that they will play this race card. And first up, she's playing both sides of this, of saying the, oh man, he's getting arrested for self-defense because he's black. And then also the, no, he's absolutely committing murder. And this is just trigger happy NRA nonsense. And then also we'll be cheering for an innocent man who happens to be white, not that it matters, to go away to prison because he used a gun, and we can't have that.
All right. So I have nothing else to say other than that I loathe Shannon Watts, and I hope she dies of cancer, of the AIDS, of the leukemia, of the crotch. And I would like to move on, please.
Yes, please.
So speaking of stupidity, Oregon Measure 114. I'm not sure if I can explain this properly because there's just a level of derp involved. But the Oregon Attorney General, a.k.a. the head lawyer for the entire state, and who I would assume had some sort of input on Measure 114 as it was being drafted, as he is defending Measure 114 against the multiple lawsuits that are in place against it, including one from our friends in the Second Amendment Foundation, the lawyer who is for the law is now asking a judge to grant a temporary injunction against the law that he supported so that he can have time to put things in place in order to defend it against the lawsuits and presumably other injunctions that are happening against Measure 114. It's really, really stupid. So according to our good friend, Stephen Gutowski at The Reload, so he summarizes it for us, and he says that Oregonians won't be able to legally buy guns after December 8th when this new ballot initiative goes into effect, unless, of course, there's an injunction against it. And the Oregon Attorney General is saying that they want to have this law postponed for 2 months so that Oregonians will be able to purchase firearms even if they don't have a permit, while also allowing Oregonians to apply for and be issued the permits. Basically, even though they drafted this law, they don't have the infrastructure in place in order to have the permitting system set up and the trainers set up. And only now are they realizing, oh, crap. And so they want to temporarily block their own law and probably get some of that sweet, sweet tax money on Christmas gun sales. And they're trying to get it blocked temporarily until they can get their own affairs in order. And it's dumb. It's stupid.
Yeah, you mentioned that the AG might have had a hand in drafting this law, or at least saw some of the drafts of it. I wouldn't be so hasty on saying that, only because this is clearly something that was just thrown together by a bunch of people that were just rapidly writing this together like some sort of like fanfic contest. I mean, it's just oh, what fantasy do you have? Oh, let's make it so this bans assault weapons, and you need a permit to buy a gun, and you have to go training and make them do all this stuff. God, oh yeah, the gun owners will hate this. And when should we make it? Let's make it happen really fast. And so yeah, so it was, because there was even a debate on exactly when the law would go into effect as it was written in the actual ballot measure. And so, yeah, it's turned out that they looked it over and decided it was December 8th, which is just a couple of days from now and in the past when you're hearing this. And so they're like, uh-oh, because now they don't want to get caught with how draconian and stupid they are with the fact that you need a permit to buy a gun. And they don't, and there's no such thing as a permit to buy a gun. Nobody can get it because there's no training classes. There's no actual permit to be issued. There's no nothing. And so you can't walk into a gun store and buy a gun. And I think it banned, yeah, bans private sales. So now what? And everything is up to a stop, and they don't want people to know. Oh no, they're going to find out what we really want. We're going to say the quiet part out loud. And yeah, the irony of the government asking the government for an injunction against the government. And this is not the first time this happened, because this also happened with the New York Safe Act, which was like done like under the cover of darkness and was like super duper shady. And in the end, like, they forgot to exempt police officers. So now suddenly cops couldn't carry guns, and they decided, oh, we'll make it 7 rounds. I don't know, because somebody knows what a 1911 holds. I don't really know exactly where they got the 7 rounds. But or it's one more than a 6-shot revolver. I have no idea, but they decided it was, you could only have 7 rounds. And yet, unless you're one of the handful of guns that holds 7 rounds, because that's how big the magazine is, nobody makes a 7-round magazine. People make 10-round magazines. People make magazines that hold a whole bunch of numbers bigger than 10, but actually magazines that hold exactly 7 or less are exceedingly rare. And so that got challenged, and of course they had to put the exemptions in for the police officers, because we can't have our peace officers carrying the exact same firearms as us. They've got to be doing better.
Yeah, but at least in that case they didn't need an injunction. They just quickly wrote a carve out and passed it.
That's true. Either way, my heart goes out to all Oregonians living under this nonsense, but also at the same time, I hope this just goes as ugly as possible, because you guys voted for this, and I hope they give it to you good and hard. And so maybe the Oregonians that felt that gun control was a good idea would both A, see how absolutely dumb this law was, and then B, also realize that not only is it dumb, but when it's run by a government that's this incompetent, it hurts.
Well, again, point out that this passed by a very narrow margin, like less than 2%.
Yes.
So it was very strongly divided. So it's not like the gun owners didn't fight it. And honestly, I think the gun owners who did vote for this are perfectly happy. Oh, well, I have to wait. No problem. I got mine.
I mean,
I think it's going to be a very rarefied group that both voted for this and are now upset they can't get a gun and have to wait several months.
Yeah, especially, certainly, I know all the FUDs that I know up in Maine who are, I mean, most people in Maine own guns, and it's just how it is. Even people who don't own guns own guns. And like my father. Father, Mr. Anti-Gun Person, all of that. Yeah, there were 2 guns in our house. They were not in working condition, but he owned guns. It's enough to get arrested on if a major ban got passed through. But many of these people, they've got their hunting shotguns and their hunting rifles and all that. And yeah, they just need one for each sport that they engage in, and then yeah, they're all set. So. You're right. You can absolutely see the "I got mine" attitude for the anti-gun gun owners.
And you know what? "I got mine" is a perfect segue into this last topic, which, oh my gosh, if we covered this in depth, we'd be here all night.
We were discussing this amongst the members of ACP, and David suggested that we make it 2 consecutive weeks of just one show. And
but what would that topic be, Weird? You're burying the lead.
Yes. So the lead story is a man is sentenced in his role for a sheriff's corruption scandal. And this is coming out of San Diego County.
Because, of course, it's California.
Yes. And you will find that Aaron hinted to this. We have a whole list of these stories from various times in the past, from very, very currently to a few years ago. And there's far more than that, but the bulk of them are California and New York because they are the ones that have most documented. But as I was talking with Oddball, I was saying, oh yeah, when Tennessee was May issue, I'm sure there was lots of corruption and horribleness going on, but you know, it wasn't documented because there wasn't an internet back then. But yes, the sheriff was sending out, I'm trying to remember what this guy is. I think he was running for sheriff, but Mr. Whale Anton, he was claiming to be a law enforcement officer while he is not. And I'm just trying to figure out what he was. He's a handyman. He installs garage doors, but he was essentially bundling bribes for the local sheriff, for both. He was running protection rackets. I mean, this is bad stuff. He was running protection rackets. He was tipping off businesses if there was going to be raids. But he was also getting people to cut in line for the concealed carry interviews that were required before you can do that. And I believe, was he also... No, he was just getting you to cut in line. There was not specifically getting people permits when they otherwise wouldn't. But there was direct corruption and involved all sorts of stuff. But it's essentially, it was a pay-for-play scandal. And part of that was centering around the May issue permitting system.
And what's worse, this wasn't just any member of the police department that he was working with. I couldn't quite find name. Maybe I missed it.
The captain.
Yeah, but that was the point. This is a sheriff's captain. Well, former. I don't know if he's former because he's been arrested or former because whatever. But yeah, a high-ranking officer in San Diego County was running an operation, whereby, you know, if you paid him off enough, you would get your handgun permit issued to you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And yeah, and so then I sent out a call to everybody at ACP to give me a couple of other stories. And we've got a whole bunch from both New York and California. Let's see, just a quick skim of the headline. Former police officers, ex-Brooklyn assistant DA arrested in NYPD gun license bribery scandal. This was actually pretty well published. We might have even talked about it on the show before. But essentially, people were directly paying various officers to get the gun permits that they were otherwise going to get denied. Another big one was, I believe this person worked for Apple, and they were giving iPads to various state stuff. I think they were giving some to schools and some to the police department, and all of that. And that was securing a concealed weapons permit. And I think actually, is this another one? Different Los Angeles one, but either way, no, this is the same one. But either way, there is a ton of these stories. I've got them in the show notes. I'm not going to go through every last ounce of them because it's mostly the same. And I will retell a story that I know I've told before on this, which was that a friend of mine went out on a date with a gentleman. And, you know, she mentioned that he was from Somerville, Massachusetts. And she said during the course of the date, somehow it came up that he was carrying a firearm. And she's always been a Second Amendment supporter. So she was very pleased to see that he was carrying a gun on their date. And she was telling me, oh, yeah, you know, like, oh, what type of gun was it? I knew you'd ask. It was a Beretta 92 and all that. And I said, and you said he's from Somerville? Yeah. Is he a cop or a firefighter? She goes, he's a firefighter. How the hell do you know that? And The point is that I knew that Somerville was one of the May issue towns that simply does not issue. Just I mentioned the fact that when I lived in Medford, Massachusetts, they just told me we're not going to give you a carry permit. And they didn't even know my name. I had never introduced myself. I just said I'd like to apply for a gun permit. They said, what kind? I said, concealed carry one. And they said, no. And Somerville is the exact same way. But if you are a police officer or the family of a police officer or a firefighter or the family of a firefighter, or you happen to be in local politics, any way that you can get introduced to the chief of police, and therefore when you hand over the application, you're handing it over in person and they know who's doing it, that might be a good way to get your permit secured. Otherwise, no, it's not going to happen. And, this is why NYSERPA versus Bruin is an absolutely amazing case, because it got rid of all of this. Not all, because I guarantee we're seeing the insolence that's going on with the various departments that are fighting this. It certainly is making it a lot harder for them to do these criminal rackets.
Just because I said I couldn't find it before and I found it and I want to show my work. The San Diego County Sheriff's Captain is Marco Garmo. Mm-hmm. Just name and shame.
Yes. Shame on you.
So in this next segment of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, David talks about knobs and anatomy of scopes. Get your mind out of the gutter.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this, the latest installment in my series on the history and use of sights and optics, I'll be discussing the details of magnified optic. In a previous segment, I mentioned the introduction of adjustable zoom on scopes. I'd like to start this segment by discussing an aspect of this type of optic that's not very well understood. I'm talking about first focal plane and second focal plane reticles. In variable magnification scopes with a reticle in the first focal plane, the reticle will adjust along with the image. This means that any graduations, such as mil dots or bullet drop compensator markings, will still be usable no matter the zoom level. The downside is, at higher magnifications, the reticle itself will appear noticeably thicker and is more likely to occlude part of the sight picture. In addition, at the lowest magnification, the reticle may be thinner than preferred. First focal plane scopes are also generally more expensive than second focal plane scopes because of the additional manufacturing elements required. Magnified scopes with second focal plane reticles change the image size but not the reticle. This means the crosshairs and other aiming marks are always the same size while the view gets bigger or smaller. This can be beneficial for aiming consistency, but if the scope has mil dots, etc., they'll only be reliably usable in a small subset of the full magnification range. Otherwise, they'll require calculation. This type of scope is generally less expensive than those with first focal plane optics. There are a number of other components in a modern magnified optic, and I'd like to discuss those next. Starting from the front is the objective lens. This is measured in millimeters and affects both the field of view as well as the amount of light entering the optic path. Field of view is the width of viewable area at any given zoom level. The larger the objective lens, the better it is for both of these values. Moving back from the objective lens is the erector tube assembly. This element contains the lenses needed for magnification and may also include the reticle in a first focal plane setup. Another part of the erector tube is the focus lens, which, as the name implies, helps keep the image crisp and clear. Behind the focus lens is the image reversal assembly. When light passes through the series of lenses in a modern scope, it can cause the image to appear upside down. The image reversal assembly corrects this before it reaches the user's eye. The magnification lenses move forward and back inside the scope body in a scope with adjustable zoom. When these lenses move forward, away from the ocular lens, magnification increases. When they move rearward, away from the objective lens, magnification decreases. For example, in a 3x9 variable magnification scope, at 9x magnification, the erector tube will be closest to the objective lens, farthest forward. And at 3x will be closest to the ocular lens, farthest back. Next is the second focal plane aperture, and if appropriate, the reticle for this type of scope. Finally, there's the ocular lens, which collects the light that's passed through the scope and presents its image to the shooter's eye. Many of these lenses will have coatings to do things such as reduce light reflection and improve clarity. All the different elements are sealed with rubber or silicone gaskets to make the scope waterproof. Before final assembly, the scope is purged of air and filled with nitrogen or a similar gas to prevent fogging of the lenses. There are several external adjustment controls on a modern scope. They are the windage and elevation knobs, which are located on the top and side of the scope at the middle of the scope body, or tube. These allow the user to change the position of the reticle for zeroing a scope. These are adjusted in either half or quarter minute of angle increments. If appropriate, there may be a bullet drop compensator knob as well, or, as is more likely these days, the BDC will be incorporated into the reticle. Zoom adjustment is generally by means of a collar in front of the ocular lens. Many scopes also have a focus ring at the rear of the eyepiece. This is used to adjust focus of the reticle for each user. If the scope has a parallax adjustment, it may be another knob opposite the windage adjustment, or it will be changed by rotating the objective end of the scope. This is for adjusting the reticle focus in relation to the target. If the scope has fixed parallax, it will usually be set at 100 yards in centerfire rifle scopes and 50 yards in rimfire, shotgun, and handgun scopes. This means that at other distances than those set, both the reticle and the target may not be in focus simultaneously. Another setting is what's called eye relief. This is the distance between the shooter's eye and the eyepiece of the ocular lens where the entire field of view is visible. Shotgun and handgun scopes have considerably longer eye relief than rifle scopes. While this can usually be adjusted in small increments on the scope itself, it's more coarsely set by the position of the scope on the firearm. Hopefully, this clarifies both components and terminology in the modern scope. Have fun and safe shooting.
When I was 19, I did a guy in Laos from 1,000 yards out. A rifle shot in high wind. Maybe 8 or even 10 guys in the world could have made that shot. It's the only thing I was ever good at.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook or MeWe pages, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I see them. I'm also a contributor on the Blue Collar Prepping blog, which can be found at bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. We're always looking for people interested in submitting posts to the blog, so please check out the site. Finally, I'm also a published author, and books with my stories can be found on Amazon under the name Brenna Bock. That's B-R-E-N-A-B-O-C-K. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
First, can I compliment David for his clip of Lethal Weapon? It's one of the great movies for this Christmas season.
I mean, that's fine. Just... you know, I'm in before the obligatory Die Hard is a Christmas movie reference.
Yeah. I mean, they're both Christmas movies.
Well, see, Weird, the thing is, Die Hard wasn't a Christmas movie originally. The script was changed by Holy Roman Emperor Constantine in 336 to align it with the Sol Invictus Festival.
If you are not making that up right off the bat, I had not heard that before, and I am done. That's the end of the podcast. Good night, folks. I thought you were going to talk about how it's a Hanukkah story, in fact. But I've heard some references that to Die Hard being more Jewish than Christian.
Yeah, I can kind of see it.
But either way, Lethal Weapon is absolutely a Christmas movie, because while there is the Lethal Weapon theme that was written by Eric Clapton, the actual music that is playing when the marquee of Die Hard, excuse me, of Lethal Weapon goes up on the screen is Jingle Bell Rock. Don't get much more Christmas movie than that. And let's face it, Shane Black just loves setting movies during Christmas.
I feel the need to share with you something that I only recently discovered on Facebook. And that is Deck the Halls shares the same meter scheme as Black Sabbath's War Pigs, and they can be sung to each other's tunes. Similarly, O Come All Ye Faithful and Twisted Sister's We're Not Gonna Take It.
Oh, I'm hearing that. I won't sing it because...
Would you like for me to post links in our show notes for our listeners to enjoy?
Yes, please.
I shall so do.
And on a more serious note, one factor that makes optics so much easier to use and why people are putting red dots on all the pistols and things like that, and why, oh, you know, long range shooters are always using, you know, telescopic sights, is because is not just only the magnification, but with iron sights, or with an optic, the target is on the same plane of focus as your reticle. So you're looking at the reticle and you're looking at what you're shooting at, and they're both in focus. When you're using iron sights, in the case of the pistol sights or your standard notch sights, there's three planes of focus. You have the target, you have the front sight, and you have the rear block. And you can only keep one of those in focus. And that's why they always tell you focus on the front sight as you're breaking the shot, because you have to pick one. But aperture sights are a little bit better than that because you only have one, you know, one sight. You have the sight and you have the target to focus on, because you can't focus on that rear sight. Either way, I like the segment.
The most interesting part about the Twisted Sister one is that the video is literally Dee Snider and Twisted Sister performing O Come All Ye Faithful.
Wow.
To the tune of
We're Not Gonna Take It.
We're Not Gonna Take It. And it's not like from the 80s or 90s. This was like, I think I want to say 2005 or whatever. It was like a Vegas show.
I mean, they're still touring. Dee Snider is still out there rocking.
Look out. Keith Richards has competition.
Oh, God. But unlike unlike Keith Richards, Dee Snider's been a spokesmodel for Cabot Arms. He likes 1911s.
I did not know that. Oh, nice.
As you should know, I'm a huge fan of the Reload.com, which is run by my friend Stephen Gutowski. I heard he recently got a new gig on CNN. And I really wanted to talk directly with him about it. I am pleased to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast, the proprietor of The Reload, Stephen Kutowski. How you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. And I've been wanting to have you on. We've been a little bit busy, both of us, but you've also got another gig besides The Reload now.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a contributor for CNN now, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity there.
So this leads me down the line. I'm sure a lot of people are having the same thought as me, is I have absolutely grabbed news stories from CNN for my weird audio fisks in taking down anti-gun talking points. And I've certainly seen CNN as being a group that has been very unfriendly to gun owners in the past. Has anything changed? What's the nature of this arrangement?
Well, I think that CNN is bringing me in as part of a team to cover guns in America. You know, I'm going to be a contributor, so I'm not going to be a staff reporter for them, but I'll be able to bring my perspective to their airwaves. I think that's what they want from me. That's what they said they want from me during this whole process. They're not trying to make me say any particular talking points or take a particular angle on story. They want me to give my perspective and share my expertise with the audience. And that's encouraging to me. I think it's going to be a fruitful sort of a, you know, partnership. And, you know, I'm not going to become responsible for everything that they write about guns, but I'm going to be there to try and bring a different point of view than some of the other people who are on the Guns in America beat. You know, they kind of assembled a pretty diverse group of people from their, you know, where they write. There's someone from The Guardian, there's someone from The Trace, there's me, and there's also a staff CNN reporter who's on this new assignment. So, you know, I think they're looking for not necessarily a specific ideology to be represented, but to try and give people access to a wide variety of opinions.
Yeah, subject matter experts. Do you know the other the person from the Guardian and from the Trace?
I don't know them personally. I've interacted with them in the past, and I think that they're good additions as well. That'll bring something different than what I bring. Obviously, the Trace is similar to the Reload in the sense that it focuses on gun policy as a publication. Obviously, it's different in that it's funded in part by Everytown, and so they take a very different editorial approach to the issue than I do at the Reload. But and then the Guardian, Abinay is somebody who writes a lot about gun violence in minority neighborhoods, and sort of a very different focus from what you see in major media, which tends to mostly cover mass shootings, of course, and doesn't spend as much time covering that angle of the story like she does. So I think they're trying to bring in people who are informed in different aspects of guns in America.
Well, that is awesome. So do you see CNN trying to do more of a push? Because I don't think this is really something that I've seen much of in others of the legacy media, having an expert, at least when you have someone that is an actual expert on firearms and firearms law, it tends to be to pad out puff pieces in a Pro 2A publication. And then when there's anybody else, they tend to be speaking to experts that are more anti-gun.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's obviously a wide variety of points of view in academia and media when it comes to guns. And what I like about this approach that CNN is taking is that they're not trying to pretend that, what the Duke Firearms Law Center says is the only point of view, or what, the Second Amendment Foundation says is the only point of view, or what have you. They're trying to give people access to these competing ideas in a way that is designed to inform the audience rather than inflame them. Like, my role is not going to be to come on and have your classic like three box cable news debate where person on each side has their pre-written talking points and they're just meant to represent the generic right wing or left wing position. I think they want something much more comprehensive than that and much more nuanced than that. And that's what I'm hoping to deliver.
Oh, that's cool. So I don't know if you've heard anything. I've really only seen anecdotal evidence of this, but I'm starting to see, of course, during the COVID-19 lockdown, there was a huge rush on guns, and obviously concealed carry permits have been going way up. Most states are seeing a huge influx, especially the May issue, formerly May issue states, like here in Massachusetts, are seeing a huge influx in permit applications. And it's always been my assumption that not all, if not the majority of these people, are not what you would call the traditional gun owners. These are not the, conservative, middle-aged, white male people who are rushing in to get guns and get their carry permits, but actually, in fact, people who might be more left of center, more from minority communities, more females, more younger people. And I've always thought that there might be the larger powers that be that have been preaching gun control in the past might start seeing the writing on the wall that some of what they would consider their safe demographics are actually starting to become gun owners and starting to learn a thing or two about guns.
I definitely think there's been a change in American gun ownership, like you described there, going on really for the last couple of decades, slowly, and then the last couple of years much more quickly. Right, as you described. And I do think that probably has an impact on how CNN and other media outlets are looking at the issue, because there's the whole new demographic of people who are increasingly buying firearms for themselves for all sorts of different reasons, right? There's not just one reason why somebody might own a gun or want to have a gun. And there's really an incredible diversity in, you know, from a racial standpoint, class standpoint, income standpoint, but also from, ideological standpoint or a point of the way people think about guns is incredibly diverse, even within the gun owning community. And so I think there's a lot of interesting stories that come out of that, which have been drastically undercovered in major media for the last for a very long time, really. And that was actually part of the reason that I started the Reload itself, is to try and tell some of those untold stories. We've profiled people like Shermichael Singleton and John Keyes, who run Guns Out TV. We've had on just recently the head of the New York State Jewish Gun Club to talk about their lawsuit against the state's new gun carry restrictions. And, you know, so it's something that I've been particularly focused on for a while now, and something where I think the major media is perhaps catching up with that trend now.
Yeah. Well, also are you the only primary source for Second Amendment news website out there? It seems like most places are I gotta say assortedcalibers.com, where I am reading and curating other people's news stories when we talk about the current events.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't know if we're the only one, right? But we're one of the only ones, at the very least, who focus on original reporting over commentary analyzing reposted stories from other outlets. You know, the Reload focuses on breaking news stories rather than interpreting them, I guess would be the way to put it. And I think that is pretty rare in gun media right now. And that was just another reason why I started it, right? Is what you usually have is a lot of major media is focused on breaking news, and they understand politics fairly well. They understand how the Hill works, what bill is going to actually get traction and what's not. A lot of them understand it better than I do, but I have good insight into that as well, working in this area in near DC for my entire career. And but the problem with major media is they don't have any knowledge about guns really at all. I think that's actually one of the biggest drivers of inaccurate reporting on guns in major media, is just lack of knowledge, even more so than political bias, even though that certainly does exist too. And then in gun media, you have people who know guns very well, better than I do in a lot of cases, although I know a lot about firearms. But, you know, people can tell you what the muzzle velocity of a 308 is or something like that off the top of their head, or they can give you really great insight into reviewing the latest offering from, you know, Smith & Wesson or SIG or what have you, in ways that I can't do. But they are generally fairly bad as an industry. I think the gun media is fairly bad at covering gun politics, and covering politics, understanding how it works, how the Hill works, what bills are going where. And so you get a lot of, like, just like in major media, you get a lot of mistakes about basics of how guns work and how gun laws work. You in gun media, you get a lot of mistakes about how politics works and what bills are going where. And there's a lot of warning that, you know, these sort of crying wolf about gun confiscation every very often, even if that is something people do want. You know, some people in the gun control movement do want to confiscate firearms, but you get a lot of inaccurate stories on the politics of it. And so I saw a space for an outlet that focuses on breaking news, understands the politics of it, and understands the gun side of it. And I think that's honestly what appeals to CNN when they look at someone like me to have on their programs.
Yeah, that's great. I as you're talking, I just thinking about, like, some of my earliest, you know, dipping my toe into the waters of gun politics with watching the 94 assault weapons ban rise and pass to which back then I was actually quite anti-gun, and I was cheering it on. And later on, as I got a little older, and this thing called the internet suddenly became available to me, and I was able to look things up, I was like, oh, wait, that's my uncle's .30-06 that he hunts deer with is less powerful than an AK-47's round or an AR-15's round that they were saying is too powerful for hunting. And
right.
This is not a ban on machine guns. And then, of course, you know, fast forward all the way to today with, you know, a reporter from either New York or LA asking somebody from the middle of the country if the gun was registered to the shooter, or talking about 30 right. magazine clips.
Yep. Yeah. All super common mistakes. Even more basic stuff than that, like the difference between semi-automatic and fully automatic is commonly misunderstood in media reports. And it shows in trust of the media, I think. You know, people tune that out when they understand that what they're being told is that the person doesn't know what they're talking about. I think it's the duty of a journalist to be informed when they're going to talk about a story. But I think the industry as a whole sets up journalists to fail on this topic, because, you know, there was just a poll that Gallup put out this week that showed, 46% of Americans report having a gun on their property, in their house or garage or what have you. And, that's a lot of people. That's like 118 million Americans. And if you look at the news industry, they do similar polls for labor, right? For union households, how many union households there are. And I think there's something like 7% to 7-10% are the recent numbers. There's a lot of people and they have a lot of political power. And so it makes sense to cover them. But every major outlet has labor reporters, sometimes multiple labor reporters, whereas no major outlet has a gun reporter, a gun beat reporter. And so instead what you get are people who are general assignment reporters. And since the media generally only covers mass shootings when it comes to firearms, despite all of the other potential topics there are surrounding guns in America, they only get the occasional chance to actually cover the issue. You know, whenever there's a mass shooting, and usually, yeah, obviously mass shootings are breaking news events in the most extreme sense, in that they're trying to get someone there as soon as they hear about it happening. And so the person has no opportunity to prepare themselves or learn the local gun laws or what have you, or the status of the national gun debate. Reporters are following news all the time, so they might have some general awareness, but this is often what leads to a lot of the mistakes. It's sort of the system that the industry has created with the way that they cover this topic puts journalists who might want to do a good job and want to be accurate and want to inform their readers instead of mislead them at a disadvantage, because they just don't have training. They don't have knowledge. They don't have, they don't even have the consistent opportunity to report on this issue outside of, these momentary, very high pressure, high emotion events.
Yeah. And it furthermore, by having them not be gun beat reporters, it means they have to reach out to experts, and how they vet those experts can sometimes be a bit problematic. So I'm absolutely glad to, and I'm not the only one who's glad to hear that CNN reached out to you, Stephen, and that you'll be making some appearances on them quite soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I've already done a couple. It's gone well, I think. And everyone I've met over there has been great. They're just interested in trying to inform their audiences as much as I am. And I expect that if that's how everyone is going to approach things when I'm, on the show, on whatever show they might invite me on, then it'll be a positive for the network and for the audience.
Well, that is awesome. So you mentioned some similarities in the fact that there's the Trace, and then you are the proprietor of the Reload. Tell people about that, and tell specifically where your funding comes from.
Yeah, so I mean that's another difference between the Trace and the Reload. You know, the Trace focuses on gun policy, so even though they have that, this is, and this kind of goes back to what I'm talking about with beat reporters. Now, you know, the Trace gets plenty of criticism in pro-gun circles, and that's fair enough because of their editorial point of view on firearms, which is that they're, you know, obviously much more in favor of stricter gun restrictions. But they tend to have a better track record of getting the facts correct in a story. You know, they're not making those simple mistakes. Certainly, you know, whether the thrust of the story or the conclusions that they're pointing to, you know, whether those are something that, you know, a pro-gun reader might agree with is a different question. But oftentimes they're at least performing better on the factual side of things. And that's because they focus on gun policy. They're a gun public. They're a publication that's dedicated to gun politics and policy. So their reporters write about that full time. And so while they might have a very different point of view editorially than the Reload, right, than I do, because we, you know, I'm a gun owner, I'm a certified firearms instructor. I own a lot of guns and like to build guns and shoot guns and so forth. And while I do my best to be fair to everyone involved in a story, you know, that's just your natural editorial point of view is going to be different if you have that background than if you have a completely different background, if that makes any sense. At least that's how I see things. And so one of the major differences between us, though, is that source of funding, where Every Town is the Trace is a nonprofit. They accept donations to run their publication, and that includes donations from Every Town for Gun Safety, which is the gun control group that is funded by Michael Bloomberg. But you know, to me, that I understand. I'm sure some people factor that into what they think of their coverage, and that's fair enough. To me, you know, the fact that they're transparent about it is important. I mean, they have to be legally, but it's still, you know, they're not trying to hide this funding from people. And so, yeah, you can keep that in mind when you're reading their stories and, you know, as far as understanding their editorial point of view. But I still think that their coverage generally tends to be better than a lot of major media outlet coverage where, you know, they're not even from publications that have no direct funding or connection to a gun control group, if that makes any sense. But of course, the Reload, we're not funded by the NRA or anybody like that. We're directly funded by members. So that is an advantage, I think, in, you know, to some degree in how our reporting is perceived.
And in full disclosure, I am a member of the Reload, and I couldn't recommend it more. It is great, and it has given me the opportunity to appear on your podcast.
Yes, that's right. We did a member segment, one of the first ones, I think, actually. So people should go and check that out. I thought it was a really good time. And that's one of the things I like doing about on the podcast is those member segments, just to try and connect with the members a little more and get a better understanding of who's subscribed. And it really is a pretty wide group of people.
Yeah, you know, actually, the member segment is super interesting, and you've had people who've written books and all sorts of other tracks of life. Of course, you have had Mary Catherine Hamm on. She's a member. Too. I was starstruck by that.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Always loved her her writing. She's always been one of my favorite writers since I started doing this. You know, back after college in like 2009. So it's really wonderful that she's supporting the publication and that she was willing to come on and do a member segment too, and just talk about things, including, I think we talked about CNN, cause at the time I wasn't a CNN contributor, but she was. So, you know, that was a good conversation too about what it's, you know, what the experience is like. And, so it's a really good, part of the show because it also gives you like, you know, most of the show is spent interviewing some sort of newsmaker about whatever is going on at the time. Like I mentioned earlier, we interviewed the founder of the New York State Jewish Gun Club because they're actively suing the state over its ban on licensed gun carry inside of synagogues. And so that was a really good interview, but it's obviously very focused on the news, and we do a news update too, where we talk about some of the other stories of that week. But then, you know, we get to have this member segment that's more laid back and personal. And I think that's a nice change of pace for the show and for me. And it's good to sort of learn more about the community that's growing at the Reload.
Well, excellent. And there will be links in the show notes to the Reload if you can't otherwise find it. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Stephen Gutowski.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, first of all, sincere congratulations to Stephen. He deserves this. I wish him every success in the world. I just have my doubts that CNN is going to treat him fairly, because when have they ever shown any sort of objectiveness about guns and gun laws? I hope he sticks around and has a very profitable career. I'm just worried that he's going to offend someone by saying something true and they will fire him.
Yeah.
I so want to be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. We talked about how Mary Catherine Hamm is also a member of the Reload, and she's been a guest on the Reload podcast, and she is also a contributor on CNN, and she actually got throttled for speaking out against how CNN handled Jeffrey Toobin, namely that they didn't fire him immediately for his misconduct, and she had no idea anything happened, but just the phone didn't ring. Though Stephen is like, I mean, he was actually while we were talking about this we actually recorded this just before Thanksgiving, and he was going into the CNN studio it like a little bit after we were done to talk about the shooting in Chesapeake, Virginia. So he's getting in there and he's speaking, and I gotta say, the more people who buy guns, and specifically the more people who aren't just white, middle-aged male conservatives who are buying guns, the less wiggle room the even anti-gun groups have to just talk however they want to talk and, you know, conflate semi-auto with full auto and, you know, claim that the rifle grenade spigot on an FAL is actually a grenade launcher like an M203, or, you know, saying 30 magazine clips. I gotta wonder if just CNN sees the writing on the walls and just knows that they need to interject some actual gun knowledge into their reports. And yeah, we will see. You know, I'm glad to see it, because certainly I've done audio fisks on CNN, and I'll probably do more. But I don't know. I don't think the anti-gun game of constant ignorance and just ignoring reality is going to keep up as more and more places. I mean, now we're talking about the places where you couldn't even get a permit for a gun. Now they have to give you a gun, or at least that's what the Supreme Court said, and it's still being argued. So the more people that are owning guns, the less people that are going to be scared of them or be completely ignorant of them. And they could have picked a better person than Stephen. I mean, not only is he absolutely, you know, brilliant in his amount of knowledge of the Second Amendment issues, and just is really, really good at presenting that knowledge, but he's also very, very even-handed in the middle of the road. I put an article in the show notes. I showed it to Stephen before he started, and he just rolled his eyes at this one. He was kind of mortified by it, but the headline is CNN slammed for hiring NRA approved gun nut Stephen Gutowski as firearms reporter. Paychecks for the price of innocent lives.
And see, that's the kind of thing I was worried about.
Yes, though Stephen quickly pointed out that if you actually look at the URL for that story, which it is not nearly as inflammatory as that headline, and the article itself is very even-handed, and it just turned out that there was some sort of editor that had it out for Stephen. But also just the bit on the NRA approved gun nut, in the fact that he's doing like a lot of reporting on Wayne LaPierre and his shady dealings and some of the problems that the NRA is coming under. So it's not like he's, you know, some sort of lackey for the gun lobby.
Well, you know who is a lackey for the gun lobby? And that would be the Brady campaign. We've got another weird fisk of more idiotic Brady dribblings.
For my next installment of Fisking the Brady Campaign's attempt to rebut Second Amendment talking points, we cover a perennial.
Statement number 6. It's too soon and disrespectful to talk about gun laws after a mass shooting.
Sounds like she's setting up a straw man argument, but let's let them say their piece first.
My name is Liz Dunning, and I'm the VP of Development at Brady. And the way that I answer this question really starts with the fact that I'm a gun violence survivor. What that means practically is that I think about gun violence prevention and its impact on my life and the life of my kids every day. I also recognize and can feel every day that most people don't, and they don't have to, and I'm glad they don't.
Ooh, this is almost an appeal to authority fallacy. See, she's a victim of gun violence, and if you aren't, you can't claim to be as much of an expert. Note that Liz lost her mother in 2003 when she was 26. And she likely wasn't even in the home at the time. The killer of her mother was a serial killer who used a .22 revolver. I'm sorry that that happened to her, as well as the other victims of that killer, as well, honestly, as anyone who's lost anybody to gun violence. And I hate questioning her authority, but if she's going to present it in such a way, I unfortunately have to challenge. I've lost friends to suicide, and like statistics would dictate, most of them were with a firearm. I also live in Massachusetts, which is the most violent and dangerous state in New England, but also the state with the strictest gun control laws in really the whole country. Also, I have to maintain a license to own a gun. Further, many of my guns have been declared illegal by our attorney general, who's now our governor. So in theory, I could be arrested right now for possession of illegal guns, even guns I no longer have, simply because it was declared illegal after I bought it. But since she's the AG, it means her declaration states the law always said it was illegal. And theoretically, I could face decades in prison. So needless to say, I too think about violence and gun laws a lot. Do I get a cookie?
But when these horrible tragedies happen that force gun violence from the daily experience of so many of us to the news cycle, I really do view it as an opportunity to wage a little bit of a fight against hopelessness.
So here's where the straw man argument happens. When pro-gun groups say it's too soon to talk about laws, it's literally days or weeks before the specifics about the attack and killer come to light. As a recent example, when the gunman opened fire at a drag event at Club Q in Colorado, many of the news speculated it was motivated by right-wing anti-queer sentiment. And many reported the fact that the killer had an alt-right grandfather. But in the few following days, the shooters declared themselves to be non-binary, and until the trial starts, I doubt anyone will know what their motivation was. And there lies the rub for anti-gunners. See, most laws are always being debated. I'm sure when the new Congress is seated, some form of concealed carry reciprocity and hearing protection act will be submitted, as will bills for term limits, one removing two term limits for president. I don't even look these up, but I know that these bills are perennial. Sometimes they'll get out of committee, and often they'll get squashed. But there are people who support these laws, and any day is good enough a day to discuss them. Meanwhile, anti-gun bills only get trotted out when there is a recent shooting, often before the blood even dries. Many of these bills have nothing to do with the events they're using as traction, like universal background check laws in the wake of Sandy Hook, where the guns used were stolen. Red flag laws in the wake of Parkland, where the shooter was arrested dozens of times for domestic violence, but never charged. And multiple people, including the shooter himself, contacted the FBI about his intentions to shoot up a school. They know that level-headed people will not support these laws, so they want emotions high and common sense clouded by grief. This even ties into the, I'm a gun violence survivor, so don't question me, because no one wants to be the asshole that says, just because your mom got shot by a serial killer doesn't make you an expert of gun laws or how I should own or carry my guns. Except it's true. Also, there's an interesting take on this. though probably not the one she's planning on me hearing. She, of course, is talking about spree killings hitting the news cycle. But we know the legacy media has to select what news they report on. When I was a young kid, I remember driving past a car accident where it was a two-vehicle accident with a rollover. My parents liked to put on the 6 o'clock news when we ate dinner, and I remember watching the report, excited to see the story on that wreck. It wasn't there, probably because no one was hurt, and it was a relatively low traffic street in Maine. So only the drivers of the cars were directly affected. Now, of course, to those people, that was the most important news story of the day. And to me seeing it, it was the most important. But honestly, I was even debating on telling the story for the Fisk because the concept is kind of obvious. While events like massive accidents and terrorist attacks and global wars affect us all in some way, the news also chooses to elevate stories that have a massive emotional appeal but may not affect that many people. Spree killings are one of those. They are by nature isolated and brief, and while they are indeed horrible tragedies, the number of people killed in a given year rarely breaks 100 people. Further, how these killings are reported is skewed. The shootings in Parkland and Uvalde have been framed as an issue of gun violence and the need for more laws, rather than sheer incompetence of law enforcement in those events and the holes in our legal system where dangerous people can slip through. The news doesn't report on inner-city gang violence, though that's the bulk of firearms deaths outside of suicide. The news also doesn't report on suicides, thank goodness. But those touch even more lives than actual violence. Hell, if we want to get really morbid, the news doesn't report on opiate deaths outside of citing raw statistics. Meanwhile, those numbers totally eclipse gun violence numbers. Unless you're very young, you have likely had contact with both people who have taken their own lives or have struggled with or succumbed to opiate addiction. I certainly have. Also, might I note, Liz lost her mother to a serial killer, and I had to dig to find the story of this creep. I bring this up because I'd never heard of her mother's death or her killer. But I could tell you all sorts of information about Ted Bundy or John Wayne Gacy, two serial killers who killed their last victims before I was even born. And if you're younger than me, you probably know these names too, because they were widely reported in the news. They became pop culture figures. Hell, Marilyn Manson's original band lineup all took the name of fashion models and serial killers. Okay, referencing Marilyn Manson is a bit dated. But the point remains that the news was once wild talking about serial killers. And then something changed, and the reportings died off. There are still serial killers. There are tons of true crime podcasts and YouTube channels that talk about serial killers that stalked victims long after Marilyn Manson's platinum album, Mechanical Animals, hit the shelves of record stores. Kids, ask your folks. Currently, spree killers have the media attraction that serial killers once had. I hope it will soon die off, especially because reporting on school shootings tend to make kids far more concerned about the issue than they need to be. I am pleased to note that more news agencies are starting to scale back the coverage of the killers themselves, including declining to name them or show their picture, except when it's absolutely necessary. One last point. She talks about spree killings being in the news, but how many spree killings can you think of this year? Two? Three? Maybe 10 at most? This is something to think about when groups like Brady or Everytown talk about there being hundreds of spree killings every year. Really? How come you only hear about a small number? Maybe some killings are different than others. Maybe some are simply gang killings in inner cities that the news avoids like the plague, but becomes a useful statistic when spree killing or mass killing can be used to describe them in raw numbers.
I think the pain and the hurt that's on display right now is pretty overpowering. I've certainly experienced that feeling of pain and trauma firsthand, and the week that we've just had has been hard for me in that way too.
Here's another point I don't think she's intending on making. We value thought and calculation in this country, and in most cultures. We say, think before you act, and patience is a virtue, and haste makes waste. In the criminal code, there are two counts of murder that are near universal. Second-degree murder is often categorized as a crime of passion, while first-degree murder is often described as in cold blood. Let's take two similar events. You're driving your child when a vehicle runs a stop sign and smashes into your car at a high rate of speed. When the fog clears, you find you've only suffered minor injuries. You quickly check your child and find that they've been killed by the impact. Knowing you can do nothing else for them, you leave your car and check on the driver of the other vehicle. and you find the other driver is also alive, and the vehicle is littered with empty beer cans. And even over the smell of spilt fuel, you can smell the alcohol on his breath. Enraged, you pull your carry gun and you shoot the drunk twice in the head. Now, second scenario, you don't kill the drunk, but you find due to legal issues and errors by the responding officers, the driver is not charged with operating under the influence, or even wrongful death of your child, and they get away. So you find out where they live and knock on their door, and then shoot them in their doorway. Now, both crimes are murder, and totally wrong. But the first one would be considered second-degree murder because somebody who's been in a serious car accident and just witnessed the death of a loved one at the hands of somebody who themselves had violated the social contract and laws of the land by driving drunk can be considered not of sound mind, versus the second case where you have plenty of time to think about what you're about to do and the consequences of your action. Murder one will get you life in prison and maybe the death penalty. Murder two, you'll do some serious time, but you'll be free again. Anti-gun lobbies, they know they can't get the Americans under good conscience to give up their rights or their property. But maybe if they talk about dead children and show crying parents, maybe talk about common locations where a person might frequent, like church, their synagogue, Walmart, school, or a shopping mall. Maybe, just maybe, people will be overcome with grief that they'll call their representative and urge them to support a gun control law. Or maybe they'll vote for a ballot measure. They don't want you to think about what you're doing. They just want you to do it.
But I view that whether it's the work I do for fundraising or whether it's the work our team does around advocacy, that is about bringing people in at the moment that they're ready to be in.
Okay, this is even worse. Not only are they trying to convince people to support their laws in a time of grief, they're trying to convince people to work for them in a time of grief. Of course, I've yet to hear a story of somebody stepping forward saying they were used by the anti-gun lobby. Of course, David Hogg has a rocky relationship with March for Our Lives and its parent company, Everytown, mostly for him talking out of turn and deviating from the group messaging. But at no point does Hogg not support gun control. So while David Hogg was a student at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High, and Manuel Oliver lost his son in that shooting, and Sandy Phillips lost her daughter in Aurora, and of course we have Liz here, the one factor they all have in common is the same thing they have in common with Michael Bloomberg, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and Ryan Bussey. They have always been anti-gun. We also see that the Parkland families actually accepted a settlement from the FBI over their incompetence. Yet the anti-gun lobbyists from Parkland use their time in the spotlight to target gun laws and the ever-shrinking NRA rather than speaking out against police incompetence and negligence that has again raised its head in Uvalde and likely will be a major factor in the Club Q shooting. And we've seen the opposite side of this coin as well. Out of Parkland alone, we have Kyle Kashev, Andrew Pollack, and Ryan Petty, all Second Amendment advocates who were touched by this tragedy. But I've seen nothing that says that this event changed them to pro-gun any more than the activists on the other side were changed to anti-gun by this event.
And so to me, it would be cruel and maybe inexcusable if the technical experts around gun violence prevention, the ones at Brady and the ones across the movement, weren't right there with our hands out too, saying, here's what you can do, here's how you can give, here's how we can make a difference right now, and here's how we can understand the longer arc towards justice on this. So that's why I think it's not too soon.
Notice that technical experts aren't here to explain the laws, how the new laws could have made a difference, or what constitutes an assault weapon, because that would be deadly to the organization. Imagine explaining to a Parkland survivor how we need red flag laws and universal background checks, but the killer was never charged despite dozens of arrests, and the police and FBI did nothing when people identified him as a threat. And he bought his gun at a gun shop with a background check. Same with pushing for so-called assault weapons bans where the killer used a handgun. The bottom line is saying it's too soon is not about delay. It's about information. And information is the enemy of the anti-gun lobby. And why I do what I do. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Too soon, weird.
I mean, that's... It is too soon with a lot of stuff, but I gotta say also their statement of, though we can't say too soon, we have to act now. Look at Oregon. No, no, no. We didn't mean it. This is, I mean, they dovetail amazingly well together with just the amount of hastiness. Oh, another great example, another ballot measure that passed very, very, very narrowly. I think it was like 114 votes was in Nevada. They actually had a ballot measure for universal background checks, and it passed by like less than 200 votes. I know that. And it got overturned because whoever wrote it for a place like New York or Los Angeles, where the dealers directly interface with the NICS system. But Nevada is a state like Florida that has its own firearms or criminal background check database that utilizes that, but they use their own system. And so the statement that, oh, they should call the FBI NICS system on every firearms purchase. And it's like, no, our law says you can't do that. They say you have to use our system. You can't sidestep it and use the state system or the government system. And so and not only did it get overturned, but they also, Bloomberg has not returned to Nevada since. So that was one thing actually Steve was talking about with the ballot measure 114 was the fact that there was very little money from the various gun lobby groups against this. There wasn't like ads or campaigns to get out the vote in favor of repealing this, and it passed by the narrowest of margins. And if we possibly could have beat them out on that one, it might be more than just, oh, they're gone now, but they'll be back again.
Well, I mean, let's be fair here. The NRA couldn't spend money on a campaign because they're spending money on defending Wayne against charges of malfeasance and corruption.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't expect much from the NRA right now because, yeah, they're trying to keep themselves above water, and that's going to be a big challenge.
So you know what isn't a challenge, Weird? Thanking our patrons.
No, it is never a challenge. I thank all of our listeners, and thank you so much, each and every one of you, for listening to this show. But a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like the hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, we're starting to do Christmas movie, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends both online and off.
I got a blog. It's called weirdworld.com, and you can hear me and actually Oddball and David in the most recent episode on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
And you can get more from me at linktree.com/AaronPillett. That's linktr.ee/AaronPillett, all one word.
And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
He's sleep deprived, and I am basically high on over-the-counter painkillers. Our sources of impairment are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.